Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in, amma ba'd. So now that we've reached the seventh week, right? Is this labeled incorrectly? It's the seventh week, right? Yeah. It's just labeled week six. It should be week seven, actually. The file name is correct, but the display is incorrect. It's actually week seven. So now that we've reached the stage of Medina and how the Prophet ﷺ and the Muslims are arriving in Medina, what we find is that there's going to be a lot more information preserved historically about Medina. And the reason is quite obvious. It's because there were more Muslims in Medina. And that means that there were more people who survived afterwards who narrated and documented the facts of what happened in Medina than what happened in Mecca. So that's one of the reasons why I'm going to be reading. This is a very condensed text. So I'm going to be reading parts of the text, and then I'm going to be explaining a little bit in detail, because there's a lot of stuff to cover, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned within this text as well. How many of you read the text, by the way, before coming? Numbers are dwindling, inshallah. Let's focus on the destination and not focus on the obstacles that we face, inshallah. So we're going to be talking about how the Muslims arrived in Medina, how they built the mosque, how they established a pact of true brotherhood, how a cold war took place between the Quraysh and the Muslims, how they were on the brink of war, what led them to war, and the Battle of Badr, and what happened after the Battle of Badr, what was the post-war conduct that took place. So let's begin. So arrival in Medina. Remember that the Prophet ﷺ had already allowed people to migrate to Medina before he himself migrated. And then he was one of the last people to migrate, and he migrated with Abu Bakr. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala be pleased with him. So what ended up happening was the people of Medina already got the news that the Prophet ﷺ and Abu Bakr were on their way to Medina. So they were waiting. They were already waiting in Medina. Now imagine the scene, right? The Prophet ﷺ is traveling through the desert with Abu Bakr. They've evaded the bounty hunters, and they're traveling through the desert. They're on their way. And everyone in Medina is eagerly awaiting. They don't know exactly what happened to the Prophet. Did he make it? Did he not make it? Did somebody find him? There's no news. Did he get lost in the desert? Did something happen to him? Nobody knows what's going on. So everyone was waiting in anticipation, hoping and happy that the Prophet ﷺ is finally coming to their city, but at the same time worried whether or not he made it or not, because it's a very difficult journey that they're undergoing. So they were probably worried. So the desert is a very dangerous place. It's a very long journey. It's a very hot journey. There's many enemies, you know, on the way to that area. So basically, the people of Medina used to go out every single day out in the city where they knew that the Prophet would actually be arriving from. And they would all go out there, leave everything, and they would be waiting and watching, saying, maybe he's coming today. And they're waiting, 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 no one's coming. They go out the next day, maybe he's coming today. They're waiting, they're waiting, they're waiting, he didn't come. Then they go out one day and they're waiting, he doesn't come. They all start going back, because when it got really, really hot in the noontime, they decided, now it's time, let's go back. When they were going back around one of these times, one of the Jews living in Medina actually was working up very high in one of the trees. And from a tree, he spotted the two people. And he said, that's the guy you're looking for. He said, this is the man, this is the man, these are the people you're waiting for. Oh, people of Medina, go out and greet your man. So he was the first person to spot, even though he was not a Muslim himself. So they went outside, and they went out to the outskirts of the city, and they began a welcoming ceremony, right? So they took their arms, they took their weapons, they set up, you know, their instruments, you know, they had tambourines, and they had different instruments that they were using, and they began singing songs. So they began singing songs, and they were welcoming the Prophet ﷺ into the city of Medina. So this was, you know, an amazing time for them. Right? This was an amazing time for them. Now just think about the state of these people. Why are they so happy? If you look at it from a purely pessimistic political perspective, you would think these people are welcoming someone who's sought after by one of the most powerful tribes in Arabia. By you welcoming him into your city, what are you getting? You're getting now, you've just made an enemy with a major power within Arabia, right? Some people would look back and say, oh no, we shouldn't be doing this, you know, let's stay on the down low, what if we get in trouble, whatever. These people are the happiest people on earth. They're the happiest people in the world because they realize what they're getting. They realize what's actually coming to them. For them, their faith was so strong that the Prophet ﷺ coming to them was the greatest thing that could ever happen to them. And they were hoping that everything is just going to work out just fine because they know that good things are going to come now that the Prophet ﷺ is here in Medina. So they went out and there was some details about how the Muslims would actually come. So when the Prophet ﷺ came, the first place he stopped was at a little village called Quba. Okay, Quba is a place where people still go and visit today. It still exists in the city of Medina, and there's a masjid there. At that time, this was a little elevated settlement, which existed on the outskirts of Mecca, about 3 miles away. Okay, about 3 miles from the center of Medina. Now, most of the Muslims who were migrating from Mecca, they also used to stop in the place known as Quba. Because this was, on the journey from Mecca to Medina, this was a place in between where they would stop and they would stay for a little while. So everyone else used to stop, so the Prophet ﷺ, he also stopped. He stayed there for about 2 weeks. He stayed there for about 2 weeks and he stayed in some people's houses. They were, you know, can you imagine, they were very tired. They were very exhausted from their journey that they had undertaken. So the Prophet ﷺ, as soon as he stopped in the city, the first thing he decided to do was, we're going to build a mosque in the city. Now I want you to think about this. He's not planning on staying in Quba. He's just here for a temporary period. The goal is to reach the main city of Medina. This was 3 miles away from Medina. But what did he do anyways? He said, we are going to make a mosque right here, in this spot, and they established a place of prayer. Right there in that place. Which shows you what? It shows you he's not even at his full destination yet. He hasn't even arrived, he hasn't even relaxed yet. He hasn't even calmed down and recovered from the journey. And what is he doing? One of the first things he's doing, he's building a mosque. He's building a mosque. So then he travels, right? Then he goes into Medina, okay? And actually, you know, once he goes into Medina, he gets another welcome. So he got welcome first when he arrived at Quba. Now he's going into Medina. Everyone is welcoming him again because this is the main part of the city. So when he was given a warm welcome, so as soon as he got to the main city of Medina, what did he do? He decided that the first thing he did was then the crowds came to meet him. Okay, so when he arrived in the main city of Medina, imagine all the people of Medina are coming outside and they're coming to greet him. They're coming to show off how happy they are. So how did they show off how happy they were? Well, the women were on the tops of the roofs. They were young girls who were singing. They were standing on the tops of the roofs and they were singing. They were singing. And the song that many people are familiar with, طَلَعَ الْبَدْرُ عَلَيْنَا مِنْ ثَنِيَاتِ الْوَدَىٰ, that's a song that they were singing. Some scholars, like Ibn al-Qayyim, they said that this song is actually not from the time of Medina. The song is not actually from the time of Medina, and it's incorrect to be attributed to Medina. However, other scholars like Zarqani came later, and they explained that Ibn Qayyim was mistaken. So there's a difference of opinion. Either way, it's likely that they were singing that song. So this was the custom in Arabia. This was the custom in Medina. The men came out with their armor, and they came out with their swords. Now, why do you think they were doing that? Just in case. Could be just in case. There's another reason. Show of power. That's how tribal people welcome people. If you go to a very tribal area, they'll come out today with like their AK-47s and stuff, and they'll welcome you in. That's their tribal custom. That's what they'll do. They'll show that, look, we're here. We're here. You know, we're so happy that you're here. We're here to protect you as well at the same time. That's their way of welcoming people. Right, so it's like modern armies. Like when they come, when some politician comes, they have like all these tanks and they have a procession of like, you know, people with their swords and their guns and all of that. So very similar. Okay, so he's welcome. Now this is the happiest day that Medina had ever witnessed. Right, now imagine this scenario. Imagine how everyone's happy. The Prophet ﷺ is coming through. Crowds of people are coming to meet him. Crowds of people are coming to shake his hand. Now imagine the other scenario that he went through in Taif. exact opposite. Crowds of people are coming to stone him, to yell at him, to make fun of him, to get him out of the city. So if you think about that, remember he said that Ta'if was the worst day of his life. And someone else, one of the companions later remarked, he said, the best day that ever happened, the happiest day in the city of Medina ever, was the day that the Prophet ﷺ came to that city. Right? Imagine, see how the difference, you know, see that world of difference. So it probably made up, like this day made up for all of that. And beyond, and beyond. So the month that he arrived was Ar-Rabi al-Awwal, okay, which is the same month in which he was born. This was 13 years after the Prophet ﷺ received the first revelation. So 13 years later, now he finally is in his own city. He's in a city where people are welcoming him, a city where he belongs. Now this marked a new phase, a new mission, as we talked about before. And it's so important that because of the transition here, Muslims would later on mark their calendar by this date. So what happened during the time of Umar radiallahu anhu, when they decided, they were deciding when to start the Muslim calendar. Should it be from the birth of the Prophet? Should it be from the first revelation? Should it be from the time of the migration? Or should it be from, you know, some other, you know, maybe the Battle of Badr, or maybe the Treaty of Hudaybiyah? Or they were deciding which day should we mark the Muslim calendar, the first day. And they decided that this event was so important that we need to mark the Muslim calendar from this day. That's why the Muslim calendar is the Hijri calendar. Hijri meaning from Hijra, meaning the migration. AH stands for after Hijra. Hijra meaning after migration. So that's what the calendar actually starts. So now before we were dating 1 year after revelation, 2 years after revelation, now we're going to start dating a different calendar. Now we're going to say 1 year after Hijra, 2 years after Hijra, meaning the first year after Hijra. So that means that, for example, as soon as the Prophet ﷺ arrived here, this is year one, the first year after Hijra. You don't have to wait an entire year. So the first day that he arrives, you're still in year one. There's no year zero. Just so you know, in case something like that, you know, comes on the test or something like that, okay? So now what happened? So while the people are greeting him, I want you to think about this. While people are coming out so happy, happiest day of their life, you know, happier than going to Disneyland. Imagine this, like a child for the first time, so happy. They had never seen the Prophet ﷺ before. They didn't even know exactly what he looked like. So what did many of them do? Abu Bakr kind of resembles him. So they go to Abu Bakr and they start greeting him. Oh, Messenger of Allah, very nice to meet you and we're so happy that you're here and everything. People didn't know. So what did Abu Bakr do? Abu Bakr, he realized what's going on. People aren't getting the point. So he went and he took his cloak and he started putting it over the Prophet to shade him from the sun. And people realized, okay, wait a minute. This is the Prophet. That's why he's doing it. This is the Prophet. Just to show. Otherwise, the Prophet would not allow these type of things to happen. He would not allow somebody else to do him these kind of services normally. But he allowed it to happen so that people realize this is the Prophet. It's not Abu Bakr. But what does this tell you? This is a very, very important lesson, actually. It tells you that for someone to have so much faith, so much belief, and to have so much love for someone they've never seen before in their life. How can we say later on that, you know what, because we've never seen the Prophet ﷺ, we can't have that level of love? These people had that love, they've never seen him before. How did they know about him? They learned about his characteristics. They learned about what he's done. They learned about his message. They listened to the verses of the Quran. So this kind of excuse that, oh well, if only we had seen the Prophet, our iman would have gone up. Look at their iman. Look at their faith. And they've never even seen him. They didn't even realize who he was. So subhanAllah, there's no excuse to not have love for the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So everyone, obviously, you know, very hospitable society. Everyone wants to show hospitality to the Prophet. So what does everyone start doing? Everyone starts insisting, no, Prophet, you have to stay with me. No, Prophet, no, you have to come to my house. I have the nicest house. So no, Prophet, I have, you know, my wife can make the best food. You know, come to my house. Imagine everyone is inviting them. Now, what is he supposed to do? If he goes and says, okay, well, you know, I'll go ahead and stay with you, it's going to offend the other people. And he says, I'm going to go stay with you. Everyone else is going to get offended. Oh, he stayed with that person. They're going to feel bad. If not offended, they're going to feel a little bit, you know, oh, if only he would have stayed with us. So what did he do? In order to not insult anyone, he decided to stay with his distant maternal uncles. So he actually had family in Medina. He actually had family in Medina, so he decided to stay with his maternal uncles who were living there, and that's something that everyone would understand. No one would complain and say, oh, he didn't stay with me. Once you stay with family, that's it. No one can say you didn't stay with me. You're staying with family, it's understood. They take priority, they take precedence, okay? Oh, okay, yeah, so good question. So the question is, if they came in the month of Rabi al-Awwal, and if the calendar starts from the day that they migrated, it starts from the year that they migrated, not the day. So the month, the first month is still fixed in the calendar. So that remains, it's just the year. It's just the year, okay? The camel being the one who decided, you know, where he would stay, right? Abu Ayyub al-Ansari was from his maternal side of the family. So that's why he stayed with them. There are reports in some books of Sirah that he, you know, the camel was, you know, guided and it chose the actual location, you know, of where to stay and all of that. Those reports aren't of the highest authenticity, so I just decided to skip that part out. It could be, but it's again, it's a miraculous type of thing. And we talked about criteria. So it could have been that the camel also decided and then he chose that because his uncles were around that area. Could be. But we skipped that because there's different narrations, whether it was a camel or whether it was primarily because they were family members. About the family members? That's what I'm saying. Remember the standards that we're applying. So it's not the highest of authenticity. It's not the highest of authenticity. Right? So if it's a miraculous type of thing, and it's not the highest standard of authenticity, then we kind of, if you can take it, you can take it with a grain of salt. So it's not the highest standard. Okay, yes, so good question. So why are we not discussing the Mi'raj, right? The ascension of the Prophet ﷺ? We will discuss it in a separate hadith class. The reason why is because scholars differ as to when the date actually was. Some scholars say it was very early on in the mission. Imam Nawawi says it happened in the 5th year. Other scholars say it was 10th year or 11th year or 12th year or 13th year. So because it's so unknown exactly which day it specifically was, we left it out because Sirah is trying to study things from a chronological perspective. That's why we left it out. Okay? That's the thing. So the same thing. Scholars are differed as to exactly when that happened. It happened, but when did it happen exactly is difficult to determine. Because not all the thing is, important events sometimes, people would remember them, but they wouldn't remember the dates necessarily. Because they weren't thinking about dates at that time. But sometimes they don't remember, like, even things in your own life. Sometimes you remember some important incident, but if you're not paying attention to the calendar or something, you don't remember exactly when it took place. Right? If you ask a lot of people, if they didn't have a degree or something, you know, when did you go to that country? When did you visit that country? And if you think off the top of your head, if you don't have any recollection, you say, probably like 10 years ago. I can't even tell you which year. So it's kind of like that. It's kind of like that. Okay? No, you done? Okay. All right, inshallah. So continuing, building the mosque. So remember, now that the Prophet ﷺ is in the city of Medina, one of the first tasks which he performed was to build a mosque in Medina. Now this one was small one, is within Quba. Very small one that was in Quba and everything. That was just kind of like the foundations of it. Now they're going to actually build a full mosque in the city of Medina, now that they're there. What is the masjid supposed to do? It's supposed to be a place where all the believers could assemble together and they could perform their prayers as a group. This is something that they could not have in Mecca. There was not a single masjid that was formed in Mecca. Why? Even though sometimes they would pray in groups, they would pray in a congregation, but they did not have the opportunity to establish one specific place because they didn't have that freedom. They didn't have that ability. So now, what did they do? The first thing they did was, they purchased a piece of land from two orphans. Okay, the Prophet ﷺ went to this specific land, he said, we're going to go ahead and build a masjid here. This land belonged to two orphans. The orphan said, we're Muslim. This land belongs to Allah. It's completely free, they can have it. But the Prophet ﷺ said, no, we're not going to take it as a donation. We're not going to take it for free. We're going to buy it. Because they're orphans, number one, and number two, we don't know what's going to, you know, we don't know exactly how they're going to feel later on or what people are going to say. So they raised some funds from the other Muslims, Abu Bakr and other people, and they paid the orphans, they bought the land. They decided, we're going to do it ourselves. So they bought the land themselves, and the construction began almost immediately. Now imagine, this is the Prophet ﷺ. He just came from a very long journey. His life was in danger. And immediately, the moment he gets to Medina, it's not vacation time, right? What's the time? It's working. Immediately, Things are moving. The land is purchased immediately. People start getting to work. Construction begins immediately. So every single person started participating in the construction. It's not that one group of Muslims said, okay, we're going to help, and the other ones are, okay, you go ahead and do whatever you want. Every Muslim played their part, including the Prophet himself. So the Prophet himself was picking up bricks physically, and he was going. This is not a ribbon-cutting ceremony, right? Like some leaders go and, you know, they go and smile and, you know, with everyone else and like, look, I'm gonna put this shovel in the ground and I'm gonna do the first one and then take the picture, put it in the newspaper, and then everyone else, okay, let the workers now work, you know, get everyone there and I have a lunch to attend. This is the Prophet ﷺ helping actual construction. Not one brick. We're talking about brick after brick, helping build, helping do every single thing. Okay, so everyone started participating in the construction of the masjid. Now how were they working? Were they like, oh man, we gotta work and you know we gotta build this masjid and it's so difficult and everything? These people were so happy, they were so motivated by their faith, they were singing songs while working. Right? You know the whistle while you work type of thing? Like they're singing poetry while they're working along. And their poetry was that, like, you know, oh Allah, there's no other life except the life of the hereafter. And they were singing different, they were making up poetry on the spot. Everyone is happy. Imagine this is like a nice collaborative effort and everyone is feeling good. So they all participated in the construction. They were all happy and they were all making this masjid. Now this masjid became known as the Mosque of the Prophet. Okay, the Mosque of the Prophet, Masjidun Nabi. Okay, the Mosque of the Prophet, which is there. But which obviously we know where it is now. But the thing is, at that time, let's take a look at what kind of masjid this was. It was a courtyard, very basic courtyard, surrounded by mud walls. Okay, now mud walls don't really hold up that much. Very primitive. Very, very primitive. So mud walls, and you have some, you know, palm trees, bamboo and all of that, covered with palm tree branches on the top. That's all it was. Palm tree branches on the top, and that was sufficient. That was a very basic, primitive masjid, and that was the Masjidun Nabi. Can you imagine? This is the most important place. And that's all they put into it. Now, what ended up happening is, the first few months they were praying, when it started raining, the rain would come down through the roof, because the roof is made of palm trees. Just a few palm leaves, like, you know, branches of palm trees. The rain would come down, leak through the roof, and there was no carpet. There was no ground, there was nothing. So it would get muddy. So it's actually muddy and they're praying inside the mud because the rain would come down. So somebody came along with the idea and said, you know what? This muddy, you know, praying in the mud and everything, it's not that great. Could we upgrade a little bit? Like, can we get a little bit nicer? So they said, okay, we'll make it a little bit nicer. They scattered little pebbles around so that it doesn't get muddy. You're praying on rocks instead of praying on the mud. That's the level of luxury that they got to. So that shows you the type of resources that they had at that time. So that was sufficient. Okay. So now we talked about in Mecca they were not able to pray. Now that the threat was gone in Mecca, in Medina, the same type of threat didn't exist. Now they could actually perform their five prayers in a group, you know, on a regular basis. So who did they call? So Bilal, remember Bilal, the one who was tortured, he was a former slave. He was the one who was selected to have the honor to call people to prayer. So they made the call to prayer, and every single time he would call out, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, everyone in the entire city would stop working. They would stop whatever they're doing, and they would come to the masjid, and they would come for prayer. Just imagine this kind of city, right? Every time this guy starts calling out for prayer, the entire city stops. Everyone is focusing on going for prayer, except for the people, of course, who are not Muslim at that time, right? So, what is a masjid, right? What is a masjid? What function does it serve? It's not only a place for praying. It was much more than just a place where people used to come and pray. It used to be a place where people can overcome the anxieties, overcome the difficulties that they were going through in life, a place where they can go and seek refuge. It became a place where it formed the center of the society. People would meet in there. People would come together and talk. People would hold, you know, important meetings that were taking place inside the masjid. This was a meeting place as well at the same time. So another thing, so the masjid was not only a place of prayer, it served as a place of gathering, a place of refuge where people could go. Another thing that the masjid served was that they formed in the corner. Now remember how much resources they had. Very primitive masjid. Despite their lack of resources, what did they invest in? They invested in making a place, a platform that was known as Suffa. This little platform that they had, which was covered with a roof, it had a little roof on top of it, was a place for people to seek refuge who didn't have a home. Okay, so they just think about this though. You barely have resources to even put small pebbles to pray on, and yet you're putting emphasis on making this as part of the masjid as well. And this was within the masjid compound. So they made this place as a refuge for homeless Muslims who had nowhere else to stay. They had no other house. So this was a place. Now, where would these people get their food? So these people would be living there, and the Muslims would be sending, the more fortunate Muslims, they would be sending food to these people. So they would be getting their food at one point in time, and also there were some people who used to go out from amongst them, and they would work, and they would come back, and they would spend the money on those people who they're living with. Right? This is a very interesting thing. So these people were always in flux. Their numbers were always changing. Sometimes these people would be here, sometimes they would get a house to stay in. When someone loses their house, they would be put into this place. It's like a transitionary, you know, place. There were some people who were there voluntarily. They had a home, but they decided, we're going to stay here anyways. Now, why would somebody want to stay in a place where all the homeless people are staying? Because they know that the Prophet ﷺ is where for the most of his time is spent where? In the masjid. So they said, well, where's the best time to learn from the Prophet ﷺ, what he's doing, what he's saying, who he's talking to? It's going to be in the masjid. Not everyone can just walk around, follow the Prophet ﷺ around everywhere, like, you know, some other companions like Abu Bakr and everything. So these people said, we're going to stay in the masjid, and we're always going to be here, we're going to be watching. Whenever the Prophet comes in, we can learn something. We can learn something. So these people became among the very knowledgeable people among the Muslims. They became the people who knew the most about the Prophet's teachings. Why? Because they had most ability to, you know, they had most access to him. So these people used to be not just you know, people who just sit there and just waiting for food to come or something like that. These people used to pray their nights. They were praying at all night. And what were they doing in the daytime? They were learning more about Islam. So the Prophet ﷺ, remember, he would go and he would talk to these people sometimes separately. And he would go and address them, and what he would do is he would look at the people who were able from among these people, and he would tell them, don't just sit here. Don't just go and beg, you know, if you're begging or something, don't just go and beg. It's better for you to go and chop some firewood outside of Medina and bring it back and sell it and bring the money back and keep investing it so that you can become self-sufficient. This is something that he used to do, and he used to give them this specific advice so that they don't resort to begging if they needed to start begging. So, let's see, where are we? Very simple, so far. Okay, so he encouraged the work. While the masjid was being built, the Prophet ﷺ stayed with Abu Ayyub al-Ansari since he had no house of his own. So now think about this. The Prophet ﷺ didn't have a house of his own. He comes to Medina, he controls the city technically. He's like the number one guy in the city. He doesn't have his own house. Before he builds his own house, what did he participate in building? The masjid. Before his own house. What takes precedence today for us? Let me get a nice house, make sure it's really good, let me pay off my mortgage, let me get my car, then we'll donate whatever we have left to the masjid. Whereas the Prophet ﷺ is doing what? First you build the masjid, and then we'll go and focus on my own house later on. So he's living with Abu Ayyub al-Ansari for several months. Before the masjid is finished, after the masjid is finished, then he decided, okay, you know, then I'll go ahead and, build, place for myself. I'll actually have a residence for myself. While he was living with Abu Ayyub al-Ansari, where was he eating? People were coming and delivering him food. Because they love the Prophet ﷺ so much. So they would come and they would deliver him food, and Abu Ayyub would also get meals to eat. Right? So now he's not ashamed of taking a gift. It's not charity. It's a gift that he's taking from other people at this point in time where he doesn't have a house. He doesn't have a business. He's not able to work at this point in time, right? Because he's obviously organizing the affairs of the entire ummah. So this was his situation. Now, after the masjid was complete, which took several months, then finally, next to the masjid, a few rooms were built for the Prophet ﷺ. Now, when you see a few rooms, remember, up until now, he has how many wives? Okay, and then he married Aisha, right? So then he has two wives at this point in time, so he's going to need at least two rooms or more. And he has some family, right? He still has some family. So now, they started making some small rooms next to the masjid. Now, how big were the rooms? If you do the actual calculations, which I decided to do just to look at it, the actual rooms were about 135 square feet. Now, just think about that. Think about how big your house is, square footage. Think about how big your apartment is. Think about how big your studio is. Now, think about the size of the room that the Prophet ﷺ was living in. And he's the ruler of the entire city. Think about that status. And the house was high enough that if you stand up and if you put your hands up, you're going to reach the ceiling. It's just high enough for a person. And you can barely stretch a person across. 135 square feet. Think about that. Think about that. So this was the simplicity of the Prophet ﷺ, even though he had the ability. He had people who were quite wealthy in Medina, but he did not want to live anything. He did not want to live, you know, in a status of luxury greater than that. All right, so now we talk about true brotherhood. So the Muslims who migrated, they were given the title by the Prophet ﷺ, the respectful title of Al-Muhajirun. So the ones who migrated, they're known as the emigrants, the Muhajirun. And the ones, and why? Because they left their homeland for the sake of Allah, for the sake of Islam. So they are known as the people who migrated away. And this is an honorable title because it means you left up, you gave up, you left all that luxury, you gave up your possessions, you gave up your homeland. Very, very difficult. It's not easy to leave all of those things behind. The Muslims in Medina, they became known as Al-Ansar, or the helpers. Why? Because they were helping and aiding and welcoming the people who had migrated from Mecca. So these people have the special titles that they're given. Now this is really genius if you think about it. Because people always had a sense of needing some type of identity. Right? And the identity that they generally had, being Muslim is one form of identity. But there's multiple identities that people have. One is Muslim, and another can be something else. Usually it's tribal. Right? It's going to be, I'm from the tribe of, you know, I'm from the tribe of Quraysh, or I'm from the clan of Hashim, or I'm from the clan of Makhzum, or I'm from the clan of Banu Umayyah, and the people in Medina, I'm from the clan of tribe of Aus, I'm from the tribe of Khazraj, within clans in between. So what the Prophet did was, he's giving them now, says, yes, you're all Muslims, but we're going to have some kind of division amongst you. Why? Because you are different. You're from different places. You have different cultures. Even though they're from Arabia, their cultures were different. They used to eat different kind of food. They used to have different kind of living conditions. The environment that they were used to was different as well. So it was not, they were different people. You have to understand. They're not just, oh, but just because they're Arab, they're the same. They're not exactly the same. So even some of their accents and stuff were a little bit different. So what ended up happening, by giving these two labels, he's creating sub-clans within Islam, by clans that are not bound by bloodline. Clans that are not bound by, you know, type of tribal, racial superiority or inferiority or something like that. He's redefining and giving, says, your privilege, what defines you as a person now is not only that you're Muslim, your second identity is that you're a person who migrated for the sake of Allah. That's something to be proud of. And your identity now is that you are one of the people who helped the other Muslims come. You're the one of the people who helped welcome the Prophet ﷺ and welcome the Muslims. This is a beautiful thing. And it actually helps them, you know, to relate to one another while maintaining some kind of independent identity that they needed to have to differentiate themselves. So, once the people of Mecca had migrated, it was quite difficult for them to adjust to the foreign environment, actually. A lot of them became sick because Medina had a lot of stagnant water, actually. It used to have a lot of stagnant water, and with stagnant water, you get a lot of illnesses. So a lot of people became very ill. You know, the Prophet ﷺ was one of the few people who didn't become ill. Bilal was very sick. Abu Bakr was very, very sick. A lot of people got very ill, and it was very difficult for them to adjust. So now, the fact that most of the Muslims had migrated away from Mecca to Medina, most of them had left their belongings behind. Like who? A Rumi? Suhayb, a Rumi, right? One of the guys who left everything behind. Most people had to leave their stuff behind. Now, imagine the Meccans who migrated, they have very little money. They have almost nothing. And the people of Medina, they still have their business. Their business is going, their crops are still there, their land is still there, their houses are still there. So now we need some kind of system to welcome these refugees, quote unquote, into the land and somehow make them integrate and adjust to their living standards, to their living conditions. So what could have been done? A lot of things could have been done. How do you get the Muslims, the Ansar, the helpers, how do you get them to welcome the Muslims and, you know, let them settle? There are several things you could think of. One of them, you know, you could think of saying, well, you know, you just encourage them to give charity, right? Just everyone, you know, give charity to your brother and to your sister in Islam, and inshallah, it's going to be fine. Whoever gives, gives. Whoever doesn't give, doesn't give. The Prophet ﷺ said, at this time, this is not sufficient. We need something more than that. Just a random, you know, lecture about charity is not sufficient. So they said, we need something more. So what they did was, they instituted a pact of brotherhood, which is known as al-mu'akha. Right? You don't need to know the Arabic term, but they instituted a pact of brotherhood. So what they would do basically is one of the emigrants, one of the muhajirs, would be paired up with one of the ansaris. Okay? They would be paired up together, and the helper or the ansari, he would share his house, and he would share his possessions with his brother, who he was paired up with. Okay, so they were paired up together like this. Now, look. Let's take a look at some of the details. The people of Mecca generally were merchants. They were businessmen by profession. Why were they businessmen? Because Mecca is a valley, burning hot, very little greenery there. Almost nothing grows in Mecca. So that's just the way the land of Mecca is. Medina is it's arable land. Things can grow. There's a lot of palm trees. There's a lot of you can plant crops, things will grow. So there's a difference between the two. So that's why the people of Medina were more like farmers. The people of Mecca, most of them were like businessmen. Businessmen are shepherds. That's pretty much what they used to do. So the difference between the two causes some difference in cooperation. How do you cooperate between the two? So the thing is, most of the land that the people in Medina used to own, most of their wealth was not only measured in cash. Wealth used to be measured in the amount of animals that you have, the amount of land that you possess, and the amount of whatever tools and other type of business you have. So because the wealth was distributed that way, the Prophet ﷺ decided that we're not going to distribute land across the board. Some of the helpers, they went and voluntarily said, we're going to give up half of our land to our Muslim brothers who have migrated from Mecca. The Prophet ﷺ refused. He said, no, do not give them half the land. Now, what is the reason for that? It's not exactly known, but one of two reasons could have been there. Perhaps I would say both. Right? One of the reasons could have been that the Prophet ﷺ did not want to put too big of a burden on the people of Medina, because giving up half of your land is a lot. Right? Giving it up 100%, it's gone. So not putting such a great burden so that the Meccans themselves, the Muhajirun, they could kind of establish themselves, they would work hard, they wouldn't get lazy, they would, you know, they would put their effort in. That's number one. Number two reason could have been, or perhaps both, is that these people wouldn't know what to do with the land. If you gave them half the land, what would they do? They don't know what they're doing. Right? Imagine you're not a farmer and someone says, here, look, I'm going to give you half of my farm. Now you take care of the trees and you sell it and go ahead and do it. You don't know what to do. All you know how to do is trade goods that are coming in from Syria and from Yemen and all of that. You don't know what to do. So the land itself would become messed up. So the Prophet ﷺ, very intelligent, probably one of the reasons why he did it, is he knew that they're good in business, but they're not good in being farmers and, you know, dealing with land and all of that. So instead of accepting that, he said, let them work on the land, you train them, and they get to keep half of the produce. That makes much more sense. They're going to be trained, they're going to learn how to deal with the land. And some of the people who are businessmen, they said, just give me some of your wealth, and I'll go ahead and take it to the market, and I'll start trading. So some people were really, really skilled in trading. Like Abdurrahman ibn Auf, he was one of the people who was really good. He just took a little bit of money, he went to the market, he sold something, and he bought something else with that money, and he sold that, he bought something else, started buying and selling. He got a really big, big business, and the guy became rich in a matter of like a year or so. So the guy knew how to do business, so they used to do these kind of things. This pact of brotherhood continued for a few years, and then it was canceled. Okay? At this point in time, during this pact of brotherhood, even the Ansar and the Muhajirun, they would be inheriting from one another. So the pact of brotherhood went all the way, completely. And this lasted for a while until the Makkans were able to stand on their own 2 feet and they got used to the land, and then the pact was overturned. So it was a temporary thing, but it shows you the wisdom. It shows you how if we're faced with similar circumstances, we need to utilize that kind of wisdom to make the same kind of programs to achieve similar results. Okay? Any questions on this? Oh, because they're living in the same house and everything? Yeah, they probably quartered off their house. So like this side is for your family and this side is for my... There's two families living in. They probably quartered off the house and said, you get this side of the house, I get this side of the house. Yeah, there's one incident where one of the companions, he even offered and he said, I'm willing to even divorce one of my wives and I'm willing to give her to you for marriage. Right? And we were talking about it this morning and saying that, you know, some people, they will have a major problem understanding this because of the culture that we live in. We have a difficult time even understanding plurality of wives, let alone somebody doing something like this. But if you understand what kind of culture they came from, and if you understand what kind of culture the women of Medina were like, what type of women the women were like from Medina, they were very different from the women of Mecca. So if you understand like these people in that context, it's not unlikely that this happened. All right, it's very likely that it happened. And this is a report that's narrated as well, that somebody offered. Now, it was not everyone. This person offered. This was not something that the Prophet ﷺ mandated on everybody. But this man offered himself. All right, so Cold War. Now, before I get into this slide, I just want to make a note that the concept of this stage in Medina being a Cold War is, I think, rarer than it should be. So most books, you won't find a deep analysis about the period, about this period in history. What you'll find generally is, in most books of history, a very shallow analysis, actually. In fact, little to no analysis, rather than just a description of events, without kind of piecing things together. You'll find it in some books, but not in most books. All right. So I think it's important that you pay very close attention, especially if you've been reading other books, and you kind of say, well, you know, I've already read many other books in Sirah. You know, I pretty have a good grasp. I don't need to read this. This is one aspect which we're covering right now, which I think very few authors, with the exception of some, like Shibli Nu'mani and them, that have covered in detail. They have covered sufficiently with a good, deep understanding of things. So let's look at the situation now. The Muslims have escaped from the persecution in Mecca. They're in Medina, right? So you think, oh, everything is fine, everything is safe, Muslims can pray, they can have their own masjid. But actually, the Quraysh, like we've been looking at, people in Medina are happy, the house is being built, right? People are eating, people are enjoying, there's brotherhood, business is going on, there's a masjid. Where did the Quraysh go, right? What happened? Let's now shift focus and look what's going on in Mecca. The Quraysh, these people are still really upset. These people tried to kill the Prophet, they tried to kill the Muslims, they tried to stop them from migrating. They didn't just disappear all of a sudden. They're still there and they want revenge. They really want to get rid of Islam. How many times have they tried to stop Islam, right? So the Quraysh are still there. So for them, this was the biggest insult. Their own family members had accepted Islam, they left Mecca, they migrated to a new place, leaving their family behind. For them, this is like the biggest insult that they could ever, you know, have. So they were really upset. So they were just, imagine what they were doing. They were waiting for the right moment to get the Muslims. Right? They're just waiting for the right time. Things are sensitive. When do we attack them? What are some of the factors? Well, one, it's a long distance. Two, you have to be, you know, you have to deal with your reputation in Arabia when you're attacking a foreign enemy. And number three, they're, you know, maybe now that the Muslims are so many, it's not that easy to just take them out. So we have to do something. So they're waiting for the right moment to attack the Muslims and just get rid of them completely. So what's the first move the Quraysh make? The first move, and this is unfortunate that many authors of Sirah, they tend to neglect some of these facts, even though they're in books of Hadith, the most authentic books of Hadith. So they don't kind of piece everything together sometimes. They just mention certain events. So The first move that they make is they send a letter to a man by the name of Abdullah ibn Ubay ibn Salul. So they send a letter to him. And who is this guy? Who is this Ibn Ubay guy? Okay, Abdullah ibn Ubay was one of the few remaining leaders who survived the Battle of Bu'ath. Remember the Aus and Khazraj tribes in the city of Yathrib, city of Medina, before the Prophet ﷺ came, most of the leaders were killed off in this major battle. Abdullah ibn Ubay was one of the few leaders, or kind of semi-leaders maybe, who survived. So before the Prophet ﷺ was invited to Medina, and before the people started accepting Islam, he was about to become the leader of Medina. He was about to be crowned king. This was the guy who was about to become the leader of Medina. Now imagine him, like, about to become the leader of the entire city, and then all of a sudden, people start accepting Islam, and they say, "Oh Prophet, we want you to come to our city and take over." Imagine what this guy's feeling inside. He just lost his power. He just lost, he was going to control the entire city. And he just lost all of that. So you can tell that it's going to be a little bit difficult for, you know, maybe having a little grudge in his heart, or perhaps a big grudge in his heart. You can imagine how he's dealing. So the Quraysh, they know this. It's not like they don't know. They know this guy was about to be put in power. Said, who's the best guy to target? You got to target the guy who has some power, and you got to target a guy who has some kind of a grudge against the Muslims or against the Prophet or something like that. So they send him a letter, right? And the letter was very clear. Rather than just trying to bribe him, the Quraysh, for them, people of Medina are like this little tiny tribe. You don't have to, they're not like tough people, right? There were other tribes around Arabia who were really tough. They were really strong. Like some of the big Bedouin tribes, like in the Najd area, right? Across in the east, where like Riyadh and all of that is today, those were some big Bedouin tribes. And they had a lot of warriors and soldiers. They were rough people. People in Medina were not really, they were not really that powerful. They were not that amazing. So the Quraysh didn't care too much. So the letter clearly said, "You've given refuge to one of our people." You've given, like, telling Abdullah ibn Ubay, "You've given refuge to one of our people." Who is that? The Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, right? Either you're going to kill him, or you're going to expel him, or we're going to attack you. We got three options, right? Either you kill him yourself, and we don't have to deal with it, and you handle the business yourself, and we'll be fine. Or you expel him, you kick him out, and then we'll deal with him later on. Or we can just come and we can attack you, and all of you are going down. Very clear that the Quraysh are intent to get rid of Islam and get rid of the Prophet. Now the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he found out about this letter. And he went to Abdullah ibn Ubay and talked to him, convinced him, says, "Look, you know, I know you may not like me that much because you wanted to be in power and all of that, but do you want to fight your own people? These are your people, right? The people who've accepted Islam are Ubay's own people. So do you really want to fight your own people? Do you really want to go against them?" And he thought about it, and he probably thought in the back of his mind as well, you know, a lot of people have accepted Islam, right? Not just a few, a lot. So going against them versus going against Quraysh, okay, fine, we'll leave it. We won't cooperate with the Quraysh right now. But this guy used to utilize every moment he could to somehow insult Islam or insult the Prophet openly, but not openly, in a subtle way. So the Prophet ﷺ is riding behind, you know, coming on his donkey, for example. Obviously when you ride an animal, some of the dust is going to come up from the sand. So he starts complaining, "Oh, this dust is coming, and why is this guy causing dust?" These petty little remarks that he would make. He would make these little remarks wherever he could, every time he got an opportunity to do that. So he kept on voicing his aversion to Islam openly. And he was quite clear about that. So now, the situation in Medina was actually dangerous. Even though we realize that they have the masjid, they have everything, now that this letter had been sent, it means that the Quraysh are planning something. So the situation in Medina was so dangerous that even the Prophet ﷺ, he had an armed guard stand outside his door at nighttime, because it was so, you don't know who's going to try and attack. It looks like the Quraysh are going to try and assassinate him or something. So there was an armed guard actually outside his door to show you what kind of situation it was in Medina. It was not all, you know, a bed of roses. That's not the only threat. So then what else you find? The biggest problem was, is that the Prophet ﷺ migrated to Medina for what reason? What was the one of the main reasons why he was going to Ta'if and why he was considering other tribes and why he came to Medina? It's not just the situation in Makkah. He could have. Why didn't he go to Abyssinia? To establish a base to do what? To spread the message of Islam. Right? That's very crucial. He's established a base to spread the message of Islam, but now you got a problem. The message of Islam was spreading throughout Arabia because Makkah was the center and everyone would go during pilgrimage season. Now you have a double problem. Now the problem is what? One of the problems is you can't go during pilgrimage season because you've left Makkah. Right? So you don't get to meet all the tribes in one location because they're not going to be coming there. That means you have to go to them individually, which is not that easy, number one. Number two, the Quraysh have clout in Arabia. They have political ties. So they were putting pressure on the other tribes and saying, you better not go to Medina to visit this guy. You guys should, anyone who they had good relations with, they were being forced to not go to Medina. They were being blocked from even going to Medina to visit with the Prophet ﷺ. So now we got a problem, right? Now, not only is there a danger on the Prophet's life, there's a danger with regards to spreading the message of Islam because they can't get it out, because they can't be in Makkah and the people, the tribes cannot go to Medina at the same time. So what did they need? Right? They needed a strategy to do two things. Either to reduce the hostility with Quraysh, or to even, hopefully, have some type of mutual coexistence. That look, okay, now that we're gone, okay, how about you stop trying to kill us, right? And we say, okay, we recognize your right to be there, you recognize our right to be there. That's something that you have to understand. Medina is a new city now. It's not Yathrib anymore. It's a city of Medina. It's a new identity. The Muslims have a new space. They're a new entity that exists within this social sphere. Right, so that space, when a country decides to become independent, they declare their independence, right? You have to what? You have to be recognized by somebody else. So one country will say, okay, I've recognized your sovereignty. Another country will say, okay, I recognize your sovereignty, right? So this is the same thing. Medina, now that it's a new entity, it needs to be recognized by different tribes. And they have to say, okay, we recognize that you're a legitimate political, you know, space that exists here in Arabia. So that means that no one can live in complete isolation from the society in which they live in. And this is a very important lesson. Because sometimes we find Muslims, they go and say, well, let's just, you know, buy a little farm or a little village somewhere. All the Muslims will just live there and we're just going to focus on our own thing. That's not the way the world works. That's not the way the society works. And the Prophet ﷺ, he understood that. You don't just go and establish yourself somewhere and then all of a sudden say, well, we live in our own place. We don't need to be recognized by anyone. You have to have a relationship with other people, some type of relationship. So now there's no central government in Arabia. So the tribes would associate with one another through either alliances or treaties. Now, if you want to have an alliance or you want to have some kind of treaty of mutual recognition or whatever it is, you have to have some kind of incentive. If you have no alliance, you have no treaty, essentially, you're at war. Right? Essentially, you're at war. There's no relationship between you. So if we come across you, we have the opportunity to just attack you. That's the way life existed at that time. Now today, we have a little bit different. Some people will say, well, we have United Nations and people who sign off. You have to get approval before you go and attack a city. Or, you know, before you attack a country, unless you're one of the big five nations, and you go ahead and you do it anyways, whether or not you have approval, you know, all these kind of things. But if you look at that kind of world that they were living in, that's the way it was, right? You either have an alliance, you have some kind of treaty where we don't kill each other, or you're just some random person that's there, we don't know who you are, and if we see you're a threat to us, we're going to go ahead and attack you. So that's the way it was. So, what do the Muslims need to do? They need to make a treaty with the Quraysh somehow. Now, why in the world would the Quraysh want to make a treaty with the Muslims? What do they have to gain? Nothing. Right? There's nothing to gain for the Muslims, for the Quraysh, because they're the ones who are in power. Right? So for them, say, we'd rather just fight you. So the Muslims have to establish their authority in such a way that the Quraysh are pressured to actually make some kind of treaty and recognize the Muslims as being a legitimate entity. So now the Prophet ﷺ, he understands this. Okay? He understands this and he comes up with a strategy. But before we talk about that strategy, the verses were revealed from the Quran for the first time where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, Those who have been attacked are permitted to take up arms because they have been oppressed. Where is it? Take arms because they have been oppressed. Allah has the power to give them victory. Those who have been expelled from their homes unjustly for no other reasons besides their statement, Allah is our Lord. So now let's take a look at this verse very carefully. Those who have been attacked are permitted to take up arms. Does this sound offensive or defensive to you? Because they were attacked, right? And it says, those who have been expelled from their homes unjustly. What does it sound like to you? Right? Defensive, meaning they're reacting here. They have to react. Now, this is something new though. Before this, Muslims were not allowed to fight back at all. Even, remember how many people were being tortured and all of that? They were not allowed to fight back. Now, because the circumstances have changed, the revelation was revealed to change the rule according to the present circumstances at this time. So now, they're allowed to fight back. As soon as the Prophet ﷺ got this revelation, he comes up with a strategy. Now the strategy is three things. Number one, it's a three-pronged strategy. He sent out armed expeditions to accomplish three main objectives. Okay? One objective is to gather intelligence about what the Quraysh were up to and to track the movements of their caravans. Very important. Gathering intelligence throughout Arabia to make sure that if the Quraysh are going to be coming to attack Medina, they know about it in advance. They're trying to figure out who are they making alliances with to go and boycott the Muslims, whatever's happening. You have to know what your enemy is doing. You have to know what's taking place around you. First thing. Number two, to conclude peace agreements with other people and enter into alliances with the various tribes around Arabia. So these armed expeditions were going out. Every expedition is going to be armed in Arabia. You're not going to go and send out some people who don't have any weapons. Their job was to go and make peace treaties with as many tribes as they can. So do you see the political strategy here? One, gather intelligence about Quraysh. Number two, go and establish relationships with as many tribes as you can, as many clans around as you possibly can. And number three, block off all the trade caravans and harass the trade caravans that the Quraysh is sending. Okay? Now, which direction is Medina from Mecca? North. So there are trade caravans which are going up to Syria. Medina's on the way. Remember, one of the things that they were scared of is that they would get blocked. That was one of the things that they were really scared of. This is exactly what the Prophet ﷺ is going to do. Now what he's going to do, he's going to send out expeditions to intercept their trade caravans so that they're being harassed. The main goal is to put pressure on them. Why is the Prophet ﷺ putting pressure on them? Why not just leave them alone? What's the objective here? So they get recognized and they're willing to cooperate. They're willing to negotiate some kind of treaty. They're willing to say, okay, these people are at a level where we can actually sit down and talk to them. Otherwise, the hostilities will never end. So this is pretty much a cold war at this point in time. No one's getting killed, but there are a lot of things that are taking place at this point in time. Okay, so we see that. Put pressure on the Muslims, disrupt their trade, right? And also their trade would most likely be used to do what? Finance war against the Muslims. So you cut off their finances as well so that they can't start attacking the Muslims with more weapons and more supplies. Okay? So this is where we are. Any questions on this? So specifically, you brought up a very good point, and this is where I feel that other books of Sirah are missing on this point. So the thing is that the excuse is made that, you know what, the poor Quraysh, their caravans are getting attacked, the Muslims should have just left them alone and everything would have been fine and all of that. Even people who try to come up with a good justification, like Karen Armstrong and all of that, their justifications are, in my opinion, quite poor, unfortunately. The thing is, if you look at all the evidence here, number one, the Quraysh sent the letter, right? The letter means that they want to attack, right? Number two, Prophet ﷺ has a security guard outside his house, which means that there's very good intelligence coming in that the Quraysh are trying to kick them out, right? Trying to kill them or kick the Muslims out or something like that, right? The verses are revealed in what state? In a state of defense. that, you know, you're being oppressed, you have the ability to fight back now. Okay, all of this indicates that this is not an offensive, right? This is not something where the Muslims are taking the thing. If you don't understand, see, here's the thing. People don't understand this as being a state of war. That's why I mentioned specifically the entire chapter is called Cold War, right? Why? Because if you don't see it as being a Cold War, if you don't see it as being a state of war, you think, oh, well, now that the Muslims escaped, the Muslims are in a 100% state of peace. Had they done nothing, everything would have been fine. Who's making the first move here? It's not about the first move. Things didn't reset. The Quraysh never stopped wanting to attack the Muslims, right? So the intentions are there, the motives are there, the letter is there, the security guard is there. The fact that the Quraysh are not willing to even make a treaty or recognize them at all is there. So making the argument that, you know, the poor caravans and they got looted or they needed the money or something like that, all of these things don't add up when you actually look at the entire situation as a whole. That's what you have to understand. If there was no oppression for 13 years, if the Meccans had signed a treaty and said, okay, you're free to leave and we'll leave you alone and everything, and then they went and attacked the trade caravans, then we could say, okay, you know what? The Muslims attack first. But that's not what happened. That's not what happened. So if you look at all the evidence, it makes sense. Here's the thing. How many caravans did they loot? Zero. Zero. Okay? They didn't loot a single caravan. Right? So people say that, well, their intention was to loot the caravan. So you're telling me that the Prophet ﷺ and the Muslims, who are so good at strategizing, they can win the Battle of Badr, they can win all the other battles, they were so bad at intercepting caravans, they couldn't intercept one. Right? So you have to look at the intentions. Right? You have to look at the political ambitions here. What's really going on? Everyone, any incident that happens, you can spin it. Anyway, remember we talked about like somebody puts their hand on some child or something like that. Either he's caressing the child, he's loving the child, or he's trying to molest the child. Depends on what kind of mentality you have, right? So to read somebody's intention the other way around, without looking at all the variables present, I think it's an injustice. It's really an injustice. Let's say they looted a caravan. Was that the intention that they were to take the money and they were going to do what with the money, right? So if you look at the political intention, right, here's the thing. They looted caravans of Quraysh. Or they tried to attack and harass the caravans of Quraysh. Did they attack any non-Quraysh caravan? No. Right? So their argument is, the Muslims are, they're going and they started looting and they started doing this. Even unfortunately, mashallah, you know, may Allah bless her, Karen Armstrong is a great, defender of Islam in her own way. But she missed this one, you know, off the mark, unfortunately. She says, you know, this is like a sport. This is a pastime what Arabs do, you know. When they have nothing to do, they just go and loot caravans. I'm like, come on, man. That's a pretty bad, I mean, they could have come up with a better explanation than that. But anyways, so this makes sense. So you look at that and it's only Quraysh caravans. They could have gone next door tribe, next door. They could have gone to the Jews, started looting their caravans. They didn't loot anybody else's caravan except Quraysh. Why? Because they're at war. Why are they at war and why are they doing this? Why are they taking the strategy? There must be an ulterior motive to it, right? If they were just after money, they could go rip off somebody else. That can't be the reason, and it's not the reason, all right? Abdullah ibn Ubay, he's a pagan, idol worshiper. Yeah. You can. See, the way Wikipedia works is, if you have enough entries in other fields, and you have enough clout in Wikipedia, then you update it, and it can be edited. If you and me and like four guys go and update it, it'll get changed back by somebody else. And you go and change it back, it'll get changed back by somebody else. So Wikipedia has its own politics. And people don't understand that. You can call it Wiki politics. Right? It has its own political thing. So if you try and modify it some way, you have to, you know, do something. That's why the conservatives, which is even more biased, so they started their Conservopedia, right? Which is even more biased than Wikipedia, right? But this is the problem. This is why people, the Arabs, were complaining that the Arabpedia or whatever, the Arab version of Wikipedia, it's by the people, but no one's contributing to it. They started contributing to the English Wikipedia instead of the Arabic Wikipedia. So, khair, whatever, whoever puts interest in that. Any other questions before we take a break? All right, inshallah, then we take a break. We'll resume after the prayer, inshallah. As-salamu alaykum.